Vishnupadaya Krishnapasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Krishnamine Padaya Krishnapasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gurbani Pacharine Yavasesha Sunjavari Pascachare Zatahinde Gurbani Pacharine Sunjavari Pascachare Zatarine Daya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sridhareta Radha Sivasadi Gobhakya
Krishna Krishna Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Ramo Hare Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare Mohare Ramo Marama Hare 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 Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Radha Gopinatha, Radha Gopinatha, Jai Radhe. Jai Radha Shyama Sunda, Radha Shyama Sunda, Jai Radhe. Jai Radha Manar Mohan, Radha Manar Mohan, Jai Radhe. Jai Jagannath, Jai Jagannath, Jai Baladeva, Jai Subhadra. Jai Krishna Balaram, Krishna Balaram, Krishna Balaram, Jai Krishna Balaram. Jai Sita Ram, Jai Lakshman Hanuman, Jai Sita Ram, Jai Lakshman Hanuman. Jai Prabhupada, 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 Sila Prabhupada. Guru Dev, Guru Dev, Guru Deva, Jaya Guru Dev. Aita Gohriba, Hariba, Hariba, Nita Gohariba. Anita go Hariba, 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 Anita go Hariba. Hariba, 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 Hariba. Anita go, Anita go, Anita go, Anita go. Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Prabhupada. Jai Om Vishnu, Paramahamsa Prashkacharya, Ashtotarasisima, the Divine Grace, Iskan Founder Charger, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, the Prabhupada Ki. Jai Om Vishnu Paramahamsa Prajakacharya Siddhi Maharaj Divine Grace Siddhi Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasati Dekor Maharaj Ki Sira Namacharya Haridas Dekor Ki Prem Sekhosi Krishna Chaitanya Pabuni Tananda Siddha Dvaita Gadhar Sivasati Kor Bhakta Vindiki Sri Sri Radha Krishna Saima Sundar Radha Kundigiri Gavadana Ki Vindavan Dham Ki Matoya Dham Ki Navarib Dham Ki Jamuna Mai ki, Ganga Mai ki, Tulasi Devi ki, Bhakti Devi ki, Samaveda Bhaktivinda ki. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. Om Aganath Miranjasya Kyana Jana Shilakshaya Shakshu Miriham Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Namo Vistam Stapistam Yena Bhutale Swayam Upakada Mayam Dirati Swapadanti Kam Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Sri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Nitti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharine Nipisasasunyavaripaskachadezatarine. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Dvaita Garadhar Sivasadi Go Bhaktavindam. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Jai Sri Prabhupada ki. So we continue with our discussions on from the book Before Dying. They said the book is finished. We're waiting on one or two forts and introductions and epilogues. So I think this week we shift from Spiritual Warrior 6, which is finished now, to doing the last editing on the Beggar 4. Now I wrote these prayers mostly in Mexico and then some in Hawaii, maybe one when I returned back to Washington. So they are, you know, they are having a certain mood according to the general experience, but also according to the specific things that I was reflecting on for myself, for the Vaishnava community, and also for the world, because all of these are written in such a way that they will help anyone who's going through the transition of, which we all are at some point, of leaving these bodies. And we all have people who we hold dear to us who are going through those transitions. So we were saying the other day, sure, there's birth, there's death. It's almost synonymous that when something is born, we know it means that at some point it's going to deteriorate, and at some time in the future, it's going to meet devastation. So I have a kind of unusual topic. Some of these are sometimes unusual. Today I'm going to compare terminal illness similar to one who's on death row. Sort of a heavy reflection, but quite similar in so many ways that we'll discuss. I had a lot of involvement, you know, with prisons. I didn't spend any time in them. Well, I guess the material world is called Vaidunyagara, shackles of lust and sex life, bonds people, attachments to greed and kama, lust. And then we say, padam padam ya vipadam na te sham. That at every turn there is danger in the material world. Or Brahmana, Bhuvana, Loka, they're from the highest material planets to the lowest, from Brahma Loka down, which is considered like heaven, there is some level of duality until we enter into the spiritual world where there is, you know, you have to leave a path because people are going to be coming in. So to a lot of people are having flu, so you all be careful to take care of your bodies, even though whatever care you take, you're still going to lose it at some point. So from the highest Brahmana Bhuvana Loka, highest material planet, to the lowest, there are places of misery, places of confusion and chaos. And so we understand that it's like in a prison, there are different kinds of prisons, different types of prisoners. And sometimes it's even a house arrest. But still, it's confinement. And it's, you know, impositions, limitations that are imposed on one. So we always remind ourselves that material body is like a prison. Material world is a prison. And so we make the best that we can of a bad bargain. So like in a prison in general, one has to struggle for survival. There are a lot of challenges that the person has to deal with, a lot of confusion. And basically, it's an environment where, you know, people are criminals. They've gotten caught. Of course, most times prisoners try to convince everyone that they're not guilty. But to some extent, we see that there's a need for a prison because there are deviations. And where there are deviations, there must be chastisements and arrangements for rectification. When there is law, there must be structures and criterions. Of course, that's the law, and there must be also a set of principles and regulations for those who break the law. If there's no arrangement for lawbreakers, then the law doesn't really have any validity. I mean, it doesn't have any relevance. If you make a law, you make rules, it doesn't matter whether you follow them or not, then, you know, what's the use of the rules? Part of the rules is to help people be reminded of what they're supposed to be about, and to keep as many people as possible moving in a certain direction under certain considerations, sometimes with a certain mission and vision. And it's also to allow deviants to be known or to stand out. It's to allow deviation to have a chance for rehabilitation and rectification. So, first, going way back as a child evangelist, I think I started at 9 years old, 9, 10. The recent biography that came out a year and a half ago in Russian, on myself, talks a lot about that part of my life also. So at a very young age, I started off as an evangelist. I was Christian, brought up in Baptist church. Well, part of my ministry was going to hospitals, to prisons, and also to mental institutions. But I think I had more, like a better word, more accomplishments or success, what little it was, in the prisons. If I was more comfortable there, somehow I seemed to reach people a lot more, being so small and so young. So it was sort of a novelty, especially, you know, for the prisoners. When you're confined like that, you're bored already, and you're looking for something different. That's one thing. But also because when people are confined, they have a tendency to listen a little closer. There's less things that they have to occupy themselves with in terms of if they were outside of the prison in most cases. Although that's changing now. You can do almost anything you want in the prisons. You have the right contacts. And what was always fascinating, you know, as I wrote in the biography, I was born with this speech defect where sometimes I couldn't speak at all and I would stutter, like, you know, tremendously. I couldn't hold conversations. But as soon as I would get into a pulpit or as soon as I would get on the stage, then I would be okay. And as soon as I would come down, I would start studying again. I mean, viciously also, you know. I would hold on things. I would stomp trying to get words out. You can still see it now. I mean, I just learned how to cope with it. But you also notice many times in the conversation, and then when I'm lecturing, it's a little bit of a different mood, different energy, different speech flow. But it was really distinct then because, like, seconds after I come off the stage, then I couldn't hardly talk. Actually, it was Krishna's trick. Because it was a way that Krishna was forcing me even then to realize that I should use my voice to transmit, you know, spiritual subject matter. And it was also a way to let me know that don't get too comfortable in just normal exchange, conversations, activities. That your real energy and your real free flow is when you're doing what you're supposed to come here for, to speak about spiritual things and to become more spiritual. So it was a blessing in so many ways, and even up to today it is. So this, there's some devotees now working on the English translation of the biography. The Russian translation is in the second, they're going to a second book now. Vajralila and Malati are going like turtles, but they're going to be working on English translation. I guess when they did this, this is a Russian author. Every time I went to Russia, somehow Krishna allowed me to have wonderful exchanges with the devotees and with the secular world. I did so many press conferences and programs at universities with, you know, hundreds of programs with hundreds of lawyers, hundreds of psychiatrists, hundreds of students in the medical colleges, and literally with millions of people. Because when I did like Good Morning Moscow and, you know, Good Afternoon Ukraine and Good Evening, you know, this place, that place, some of those programs, especially the ones in Russia, in Moscow, they were for the whole, you know, CIS. And that was, I guess, for, you know, 300 million people. They have TVs. Most people do these days. So they were very large, extensive programs. And my books are selling, of course, very nicely there. So one Russian author, seeing some of the way that I was doing certain things, I guess thought it would be good to write a biography. And she wrote it in such a way that it's for the secular community as well as the, you know, the spiritual community. And of course at that time we were kind of wanting biography. You write biographies or autobiographies when people were, you know, out, and when they're gone, they're checked out. In many cases, especially when it comes to Vaishnavas, we don't always do that while someone is still in the body, still alive. But I guess somehow the Lord in the heart was directing her to do it now, and so somehow it came about. And now we have the English translation. Now, of course, as we were saying, whether I stay for longer than all of you, or whether I leave in weeks or months or a year or whatever, that we'll see. One aspect of me is getting stronger right now during this period. You see, I'm gaining a little more weight. Those who are cooking, you see, I'm eating more. Those around me, see, I'm back to my aggressive, passionate self. So, and the other thing was that my last job, I didn't have many jobs because I joined Krishna Consciousness very early. Well, I went to university and the university helped me very nicely. When I went to Princeton, it's the reason I chose Princeton. They gave me such an amazing package that I couldn't say no. My director of the prep school I went to told me when I was applying for universities, he said, you can apply to any school you want in the world and you'll get accepted. And I said, what do you mean? Because around that time it was in the 60s. And especially in America, there was a big federal move to integrate some of the schools. So Princeton was the southernmost northern school. It basically was a school for, you know, wealthy southerners. Even the first dormitory I stayed in had a big suite. Then next to it was a small room, and a big suite in a small room. So one day I asked one of the proctors, why is it set up like this? Every place has a big suite and then one little room. So that used to be the room that when the boys would come, they would bring their slaves, and the slaves would stay in the single room and would take care of them while they were at the university. So it had that kind of history. Confederate flags everywhere. Anyway, I chose that school. I was interested in, of course, typical schools, Harvard, Yale, Brown, Oxford, Cambridge, etc. But Princeton, they offered me a full scholarship academic scholarship, and they offered me money so that I could go back and forth to the ghetto during the holidays so I wouldn't have a cultural shock. So they paid for my transportation, literally. And that was the idea, that I could be able to go, wouldn't have to stay at the school or be a strain during holidays, but I could go back and forth to, you know, to my roots, so-called mature roots, in this lifetime. And they also were so concerned, because they had so few minorities, Indians, Africans, Latinos, etc., at that time. They were trying to be very magnanimous, but they also were trying to be very clear. Look, nobody fails in this school. We don't need a bad record. So we may accommodate the minorities, but you guys get to pass. And my case was very unusual because I had gone to these ghetto schools, and I graduated from East Tech High School, the technical school. Basically, then it was turned over to academic school. So I practically hadn't had any serious grammar course. And then I graduated from there, 12th grade, and I went a year to this prep school. And I was the first black graduate of the prep school. But so I went into a very, like the complete opposite, a school where people weren't even thinking of going to university, school where people were just caught up in a lot of tamagoon. Then I went to this prep school where people were caught up in sophisticated tamagoon. But everybody was going to universities, and everybody had a long history, and in many cases, the uncles or fathers were presidents or the deans of the university, so they knew they were going to get in. And they knew they were going to have a good job because they were going to join their father's company. So they were very wealthy people there, mostly, for the most part. So the principal told me I could go to any school I wanted to because I fitted a minority category. At the same time, he said I wouldn't be a risk. He said any admissions office would realize that what you did this year, you were at the prep school, shows that if you have the exposure, you excel. Because I did extremely good in things that were new to me and to the students there, and courses like physics and math, where I should have had a foundation, which I didn't, and they were harder, but somehow I still passed. So I said, oh, interesting. So then we just waited till the admissions offices sent out my acceptance. And at those schools, you don't have to so much work hard at the end because you have all your records, and then the people come, you know, to recruit you. So I chose Princeton because they gave me all of these packages, full scholarship. They gave me money for going back and forth. And they gave me money to buy clothes. So I actually saved money when I was in school. And the reason they gave money to buy clothes is that they felt that I shouldn't have to take a job, because they were afraid that if I had a job, which normally, you know, students do, that might be overwhelming and cause me not to do good. So I had a ride, huh? It was pretty interesting. I thank those people. When I graduated, even though I wasn't going to go to school in America, the trustees gave me scholarships to go to the School for International Law, which I became a devotee then, and never used the money. But they were so kind. They brought me in, and they got to get rid of me. Now, the point I'm bringing this up is that during that time, I had one of my last job, and it's related to this discussion. So in New Jersey, I had a chance to work with the public defender. I was studying a little bit of international law in a course, and I was very much social-minded, and etc. Of course, I was leader of student council. So what happened then is that I had this opportunity to the assistant to the public defender and a special project of organizing programs for penal reform for the state of New Jersey. That meant it gave me a chance to visit and to monitor what was going on, you know, for all the prisons. This is like a good arrangement that Krishna was helping me to be reminded that the material world is a prison, and how people get so engrossed in this prison. So by this time, I start getting deeper to my spirituality, and I would purposely spend more time with prisoners who were in solitary confinement, and also, you know, some on death row, because I saw they were very introspective, or they're very deep in some ways, because for them, you know, you either go crazy, which a lot of them did, or you start reading more and thinking about life and thinking about what you could have done and wanting to help others not to do what you've done. So it was interesting kind of exchange. And after that, of course, then I continued after I left Princeton for a little while. And then I left the job and I went to Dallas and, you know, joined the Satsu Maharaj in our school in Dallas. Another experience I had with prisons is the first project we had in the Washington area, Washington, D.C. area, Lower Capitol Hill. We had a restaurant and a preaching center. And we were doing some social programs, social spiritual programs, while we were doing our distributing prasadam and our regular preaching. So we had one program where we were visiting. We had a program with different companies, businesses, that had excess inventory, and we had a way how they would give sometimes things through us for us to then arrange for them to go, you know, to impoverished or to needy. Like some companies making shoes, and they have excess inventory of shoes, and so the idea is not just to give them, because sometimes you give them and they don't go to places that they're designated for. So even just trying to give something away, you have to have some type of criterion, or say you have to have, you know, some a legitimacy. When people give you something, they want to know it's going to reach its target. So somehow we were accepted, you know, as legitimate in that sense, and we would get things, you know, shoes, coats, whatever. And we would then not take it ourselves, but see that it would go from one warehouse to the places where it was designed for. Now, we also had a program, because I was interacting a little bit with the mayor then and some of the other people in Washington. And we were trying to see how we could be relevant, so they wouldn't just see that we're just the Krishna people who are just meditating and chanting ourselves and not concerned about the community. And plus, by being in the Capitol Hill area, it was just natural that here we are in the heart of the government, that we should have some sort of impact in some way. So then we started a program to help prisoners make their transitions. And so when some were released, they would come to the restaurant, we'd feed them and try to counsel them. So then I got a little discouraged, because I saw how many of these prisoners did better when they were in prison, unfortunately, when it came to their spirituality. And once they were out, they get bombarded, I guess, with so many of the old patterns, old friends, old environments. And the majority of them, after being with us for literally just a couple of weeks, they would get back into their same bad habits. So we also felt this wasn't the best kind of environment to, you know, subject our devotees to. We didn't know sometimes what some of these people may, you know, again begin to do. A lot of them went for drugs and other things. But I gave that preface because when I was writing this and thinking about prison or one on death row, I was reflecting on some of my prison experiences as an evangelist of preaching, as working with the public defender, and trying to organize better arrangements for prisoners in penal reform, and then looking at as a devotee trying to return to counsel prisoners. So this particular meditation talks about death row. Now, you think of someone who's on death row, they're dealing every day with the fact that they're going to be executed, and for them, you know, each day is getting closer to that time of execution. And in many cases, They're fighting like anything, trying to get around it, hoping that some type of intervention will take place, some mitigating circumstances will change everything. So it's quite similar to a person who has a chronic illness, is that they're confronted with, in the near future, that death is going to come upon them. The sickness is going to execute them. And they have to look back at their past and deal with the present in an interesting way, mindful and in a precarious way, etc. So we read this short meditation in making this comparison. So the title is Being on Death Row. Being on Death Row. Some states have capital punishment, some, you know, do not. Sometimes people are shocked to know that we as spiritualists honor capital punishment. You see, in theory, we do. Because when there's a crime, the chastisement should be in proportion to the gravity of the crime. And that when there's crime, when there's criminal activity, one is definitely held accountable, because even if they somehow get away, we know that karmically they're held responsible. So the idea is that since one definitely will be held responsible, if they are able to eradicate, excuse me, that karma in this lifetime or as soon as possible, then they won't have this fallout or the lingering karma later. See, like someone now who commits a crime, kills someone, and they get life imprisonment. So even if they, you say, are forgiven or have compunction and regret, that's called in Sanskrit kshama, forgiveness. This is what is called anugraha. And that means you can be forgiven, but unless you do what's necessary to erase or to rectify, you're still karmically taxed. It's like somebody steals something from someone. So the person may forgive them, but if they don't also do something to help to set balance what they brought to imbalance, then they're still taxed with some karmic responsibility. So someone is forgiven, they say, okay, I'm going to work for the next 6 months, take out this much of my salary, and pay you back what I stole. Now they're forgiven, and they've rectified the situation. So people often think that it's just a matter of only forgiveness to deal with karmic issues, but it's forgiveness, and then there is rectification or adjustment based on what one has put into dissonance or disturbance. And this just shows how people are so connected. It shows how law is so strict and rigid and fair. Now sometimes somebody can do a similar crime and one person gets life, another person gets off because they have a better lawyer. But spiritually and with proper rulership, there's just clear laws, and of course there's always exceptions, and mercy is always there. But mercy is also categorized, how the mercy goes out. And the exceptions are also categorized. And so there are certain boundaries in such a way. So we honor capital punishment, given that there is proper executive and judicial arrangements, because now people can be accused and be sentenced to death, and the way the law functions, or the judicial system, in some cases they're not actually guilty. So to have strict capital punishment could mean a lot of people who may later be found to be innocent, or who are innocent and they, of course, die a life sentence or get out after some point, those persons would have been abruptly killed. So we say, in a proper order, where the legal system is good, executive system, the judicial system, all those things in place, somebody commits a murder, such a capital crime, then there should be capital punishment. So such person would definitely be one on death row. Having cancer or chronic illness is a death sentence. It is somewhat similar to being convicted and sentenced to death. When the doctor showed me the chart of advanced melanoma cancer, they added this percentage of people live 6 months, this percentage 1 year, 2 years, and something like 10% of people live 5 years less, and that was it. So it was like a death sentence, in essence, by Orthodox considerations. It is somewhat similar to being convicted and sentenced to death. A person on death row experiences symptoms of the critically ill. Each day is an intense struggle in the dealings with one's fate. One may feel shock, angered, feel grief, self-pity, and depression. Similar kind of symptoms. The prisoner knows that the warden has arranged with his executioner an exact date and time for his demise. We all have an exact day and time when we're going to have to check out of this body. However, the self-realized soul is not in the least bewildered by the impending death, but sees the appointment with death as a victory and graduation ceremony. It's interesting that when a Vaishnava dies, we have what's like a victory celebration. You say, Jai, you know, we have a feast and reflect on this person's, some of the leelas or pastimes. Although we feel some sadness because we won't be able to relate to them in a certain way. But basically we say victory because we know the person either went back to Godhead or they have gone to a higher state, because if they have honestly engaged in their devotional services, then their next situation will always be better than their present situation. Either they've completely graduated and go back to the spiritual kingdom, never have to take mature bodies again, or they go to join Krishna's roadshow, where they're having one more lifetime in a mature universe, associating with pure residents of the spiritual world, and newcomers who are now getting free of any last residue of material attachments. This is the nature of the roadshow. And then you go back to the spiritual world. So in other words, in some universes, Krishna is having particular pastimes. And he's brought special nitya siddhas, pure devotees, with them. So there are times when we have some more stuff that has to be worked out before we can go directly back to the spiritual world. We go and join that roadshow. We say roadshow is the term. You know, roadshows, they travel and they move around, you know, with a group or a troop. So we join that, and by associating with such persons, we learn all the mindsets and we get more involved in the deep, pure, transcendental spiritual culture. Because by associating with such great souls, their love and devotion spills over and it extinguishes any unnecessary things that are there. So Bhagavad Gita explains how this, you know, the nature of the soul. The Tvaivaham Nito Nasam Natam Nimi Janani Baha. Krishna is telling Arjuna, never was there a time that you did not exist in these kings. The person in knowledge is Dira. They're undisturbed by such activities. They see how from a baby to youth to teenage to an elderly person, that the soul is constantly there, but the body is changing, so that, you know, they're not bewildered. The prisoner on death row knows that many have also been sentenced to die before him. One of the most amazing things is that everybody is having to die, and many people have died before us, but most people function or act in such a way as if they're not going to die themselves. And in the future, there will be others. He wonders what each person did and warrant execution. So the person on death row is looking at what he has done or she has done that has brought them this fate. But they're also wondering who else has been executed in the gallows or the electric chair, and what did they do? And what was their meditations? Those months or weeks before they, you know, met their demise. He wonders what each person did that warrants execution, and what were their last few days and hours like for them. He thinks how easy it is for a person to make a mistake, which can destroy his or others' lives. You think about that, how delicate material existence is. You can be so successful, and you can make one mistake in your business and go bankrupt. You can be so successful, and do one activity with lack of integrity, and you lose your license. You can have so many, can be in the medicine field, medical field. You can be a surgeon, and you can have saved so many lives and did so much. And you have one malpractice or one mistake, and your whole career can be ruined just overnight. You can be the topmost politician, and you make one mistake, you know, one prostitute, one gambling affair, one this one that, and you know, you're finished. You're infamous. Of course, whatever we do that's good, it's also part of our record, and you know, there's mitigating concerns. It can take a very long time to mature, grow, and build up a project or one's career or life. We all know people who spend a whole lot of time building up their careers, different projects, but somehow they weren't able to maintain their integrity, and they did something that literally ruined them. And it's as if all that they had done before just didn't mean very much, because people now know them based on that deviation. However, and it happens, you know, in some of these people who are on death row, some of them may have had a pretty good record for most of their life. And an act of passion or some anger or something that had come upon them, some cases seemingly extemporaneously, and now they've done something that's unjust, they've done an injustice, and now they're, you know, they have to meet their demise. However, in a few minutes, all those can be altered or destroyed. Once one has an abrupt change or serious mistake is made, serious consequences follow, even death. People have been very healthy. They come down with a disease, and now their whole life changes, similar to death row. However, the sufferer lies so is not in the least bewildered by his impending or her impending death. But they see the appointment with death as a victory and graduation ceremony. Just like in the case of the critically ill, sympathizers may visit to express their grief, support, and condolence. Of course, they all mean well, but often their bewilderment and sadness brings on greater problems, or puts one in even more in a helpless state. The prisoners and the critically ill are happy to receive guests who are thoughtful, loving, and caring toward them. However, at the same time, they are not so eager for those so close to them to see them in their present, devastated, or precarious position. When such companions do visit with them, everyone is reminded of the prisoner or the critically ill's impending death. However, the self-realized soul is not in the least bewildered by their impending deaths, but they see the appointment with death as a victory and a graduation ceremony. You see that when somebody is on death row or they're critically ill, especially dear ones, you know, come to visit them. So people have sympathy, they have compassion, they offer their condolences. And sometimes, you know, it's good, sometimes it makes a person realize how critical their situation is. Somebody's very ill, someone comes in and looks at them, oh, you look horrible. What happened to your this, that, with all those tubes doing in you, etc. I gave the story once of one elder devotee in Croatia, and there have been many cases of this. She was dying, she was quite ill. She had been a Pujari. She was a mother of, you know, of another devotee. And I went to see her, and I was telling devotees how amazing it was that even though she was so bedridden and so ill, that she was so vibrant. And she was explaining to me how she was now doing puja, manasi seva, or puja in the mind, where previously she was doing this devotional service. She was a pujari. She she was physically taking care of the deities. So she didn't let her sickness interfere with the service that she does. So now she was doing it even more, in a more elaborate way, more conscientious and meticulous way, in her mind. And she could have no restrictions on the wonderful things that she was offering, you know, to Krishna. So we all saw by visiting her that she uplifted our spirits. There have been cases of devotees who were leaving the body, and we see how that when visiting them, if their devotion has been rather strong up to that point, then Krishna will allow them to focus in a very intense way. See, one doesn't have to worry so much, although we think about what is the mind going to be like at the time of death. But if during the time of life we've had quality devotional meditations and reflections and activities, then Krishna will see that the mind will kick in such a devotional way so that the soul will be carried, you know, to its actual next destination. It's not that you can just be so devotional that somehow at the time of death you just kind of lose it during that, you know, that hour or so, and now you got to come back in another body. Or that you can be very devious, and then at the time of death somehow you just become very spiritual. Just special mercy can be there, but it's usually an aggregate of what our desires and thoughts were previously, and they add up to a certain resultant. And then at the time of death, that focuses the gives a direction to the soul. So in these cases where one is not bewildered by these changes, then when the time of death comes, then so much of the devotion from the past just aggregates, and it allows one to enter into transcendence. Each day the prisoner on death row and the critically ill are praying for a miracle. The critically ill is happy that by some, that is hoping that by some miracle the disease will go into remission, or that some special medicine or doctor will be able to save their lives. I can't believe all the different, you know, kind of modalities and protocols we've been trying. Ekavir could probably write a book to help future cancer patients on different treatments and things. I mean, we have research from all around the world on different kind of allopathic and alternative types of treatments. And then, of course, we have the NIH, National Institute of Health, that has lots and lots of researchers. And so in our case, they at one point suggested, we've tried everything, but you can try now the experimental trials at NIH. And of course, those experimental trials are just that. They're experimental. Sometimes they've saved lives, sometimes they've taken people's lives. And when I first went there, I saw this sheet they wanted me to sign. And basically it said that we cannot guarantee any help for you, but we can guarantee that you can help science. And then I found out that some people they give the medicine to, and some they don't, you know, because, you know, they have to do, you know, do the evaluation, your placebo effect. And even the doctors who give it, administer to you, they're not supposed to know if they're giving you the actual, what do you call it, vaccine, or they're giving you the placebo. And so I thought, okay, so it's an experiment, and I may do all this and not even get the medicine anyway. But interesting. But it's good in a sense. People don't have insurance, and especially in a case where you don't have any other alternatives, so what do you have to lose? I guess they feel that way, and it's practical. If what normally is available can't help you, and if they kill you, you're going to die anyway. And if they save your life, they save your life, and you help science. So that one we didn't try. The others we did. The prisoner is praying that his appeal will be accepted. Because some of these people are in critically ill situations. They're hoping for a miracle, but they're also hoping that maybe one of the these vaccines or trials that hasn't been fully accepted, that perhaps this may interfere intervene with their particular case. It's like the person on death row is thinking that, you know, maybe some kind of miracle will happen, that the lawyer will be able to find something mitigating to turn the case around. Some of the evidence will come up. The governor will give pardon. So they're just hoping that up to the last minute, Pappy, that something may happen. Sometimes it's just that close. The day of the execution, then there's a change. They try to keep a little flame of hope burning up until their actual inevitable death. However, the self-realized soul is not in the least bit bewildered by his impending death, but he sees the appointment with death as a victory or graduation ceremony. The prisoner on death row, as well as a critically ill person, often wonders how they got into their present devastating condition. They both start looking back at their lives, thinking, what could he or she have done in a different way? They have many flashbacks of wonderful encounters and experiences, and at the same time, they are aware of many foolish things that they did. They realize if they were able to live their life over again, they would do many, many things differently. So sometimes when we're at that point of critical illness or somebody's on death row, comparing these similarities, that once one is in that space, then they're looking at what they could have done in a different way. In several cases, their priorities would change. Now that death is impending, it is too late. The prisoner is offered his choice for his last meal. But just as in the case of the critically ill, food no longer seems to nourish the body. One may either have no appetite, or maybe beyond feeling or having a need to eat anything. You know, when you're very much in anxiety, or you're very sick, it's like now so many devotees have the flu. So many of the devotees, while they have the flu, they have very little, you know, desire to eat, you know. Or if you get really upset about something. So, again, similar. Because some people have the opposite. They think they're going to die. I mean, they're on death row. And they just, you know, stuff themselves. Both persons realize the illusion of trying to nourish or energize the body. It's going to be gone soon. As it is on a fast path to total annihilation and devastation. However, before being sentenced to death or before one comes down with a critical illness, most of one's waking hours were focused on stimulating the physical body. Impending death forces one to be confronted with how temporary and fragile that the body is. Death is a destroying but powerful teacher. However, the self-realized soul is not in the least bit bewildered by his impending death, but he sees the appointment with death as a victory and graduation ceremony. And two more paragraphs here. Therefore, according to how one has lived and one's aggregate thoughts at the time of death, these thoughts will form a resultant which will help direct the soul to its nearest destination. The prisoner on death row, as well as the critically ill, wonders what will be their last thoughts as they get called out of their bodies by death. In most cases, they are not aware that the consciousness at death will determine their next body. However, the self-realized soul is not in the least bit bewildered by this impending death. He sees the appointment with death as a victory and graduation ceremony. The condemned prisoner, as well as the critically ill, wonders who will be there with them when they take their last breath. We often think like that. One of the fears people have is dying alone. Or you think that when you die, you know, is the people who you care about the most, will they really be there for you, etc. The person on death row may think the same. Who's going to be looking at them when they, you know, have this, when they press the button or whatever, how the person is killed. Life is an accumulation of so many breaths. People normally waste so much energy as they engage in frivolous conversations and sports instead of engaging in Krishna Katha, or talks about the Lord. They pursue Grama Katha, or mundane discussions. As one watches, their thought, their speech will be more palatable and constructive. Proper thoughts produce proper speech, which produces proper actions, which produces proper, of course, habits, which will produce a proper culture. Presently, most people are addicted to their bodies and material sense gratification culture. Therefore, when something auspicious happens to their bodies, they become totally frustrated. Bhagavatam has this reflection like that. One must be proper in mind, proper speech, and to hear with rapt attention. One must have all of these things in the proper state. So then we conclude, however, the self-realized soul is not in the least bewildered by his impending death. He sees the appointment with death as victory, as a victory celebration, and again graduation. When that final appointment time arrives, and we conclude with this, and the soul departs from the body, what was life simply becomes a corpse. The condemned prisoner, as well as the critically ill person, the body must, in both cases, must be disposed according to the actual tradition, religion, culture, situations, and condition. As everyone walks away from the body, enemies, strangers, friends, and family will all leave it to never see it again. Death brings closure. Just think of that. When each of us die, all those who are closest to you, doesn't matter who it is, and even enemies and strangers who may have come to the ceremony, everybody is going to walk away from you. But what goes, of course, is the soul, and their love and dharma follows. Death brings closure. That means we can't be overly attached to anything and anybody, because they're going to walk away from us, and we're going to walk away from them. They can't die for you, or eat for you, or sleep for you. Death brings closure to one's existence in this previous body and changes the relationships that previously existed. Only those spiritual connections will permanently remain with us. Therefore, so much of what we normally hold on to and see as most important is not only temporary, but will walk away from us, whether one is on death row, subject to critical illness, or one dies a so-called normal death. Everyone has been sentenced to death the same day that they were born. Everyone must prepare himself or herself for the appointed day. However, the self-realized soul is not in the least bit bewildered by his or her impending death. He sees the appointment of death as a victory and graduation ceremony. I am the lowly beggar who is on death row, waiting for a miracle of divine intervention or a victorious departure. Hare Krishna. So we looked at today. I talked a little bit about my history of working in prisons as a child evangelist, as an agent for the public defender's office, working with penal reform programs, and as a devotee trying to accommodate, like a halfway house affair of helping prisoners to integrate, you know, back into the world. We talked about the reason why Vaishnavas honor capital punishment. But our main discussion focused on showing the similarities between a critically ill person who is sentenced to death by their terminal illness, and similar to someone who's on death row, who has found themselves confined and now having to wait some time, you know, before the execution. So much of the meditation was showing on both cases, you know, there can be depression, anger, fear. In both cases, one looks back at the past, reflects on the present, is uncertain about the future, hoping that some kind of miracle may take place to change what the inevitable fate seems to be. Where in most cases there's little turnaround, but in some cases, you know, there is. But in each situation, one kind of looks at how they got into that sometimes. And in some situations, just a mistake, you know, a passion. A person does a criminal act, even though they kind of would normally do that, but they've done it. Now they have to suffer the consequences. In other cases, it's been a pattern. So that pattern has been changed. They've been in and out of jail for so many times, and now the crimes get worse and worse, and then they make a murder, and now they're confronted with execution. But the real issue is that this is we're born. We have a sentence. We are sentenced when we come into this world. The devas, the higher authorities, according to our previous life, they've arranged a package for us. So we come in a certain race, a certain gender. We have certain, you know, kind of a physiognomy. We have a certain environment that we're going to live in or live in different times. All of that is arranged even before, you know, the fetus comes out of the womb. And so karma follows us based on what the previous life was. And then the next life will be very similar in the sense that according to what we did in this life, something is already being arranged for our next life or for our eternal existence. So in either case, it's very much this element of kala or time factor is there. And there is the factor, of course, of free will. How we use our free will produces various types of results. Various types of, we get various kinds of reciprocations based on how we use the free will. So we don't want to look at life in a gloomy way that, okay, I'm born and I'm 10 years dead. I'm 15 years old, so I'm 15 years, you know, dying now. But it's actually true that how old we are means how long we've been in the body and how long it's begin to gradually, you know, deteriorate, you know. And so we don't really know who's really old because we don't know who's going to die next. One may be 75 years old, but they're going to live to be 100. One may be 10 years old, and they're going to live only to be 12. So that person who's 10 is really older in the sense that they're closer to death. They're dying faster, even though they're only 10 years old. So we have any questions or any comments? This one, I think, was written, I wrote this in Hawaii. But I've written a lot of, most of these in Mexico and Hawaii. Some of my caretakers will be listening to some of these tapes because the discussions we're having are going to our TV ministry, Washington DC Cable, and then of course now they're going on the websites. And so some of those doctors who were taking care of me, practitioners, when they saw me, I was writing while they were trying to put the IVs in me and give me the shots and the ozone and all of this, they realized, oh, the guy wasn't just wasting his time. Or he wasn't writing just to deal with his fears with, you know, not looking at the needle. I was absorbed in, you know, these kind of meditations.
Maharaj, you mentioned the principle of anugraha or, I guess, atonement. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how one can become free from certain patterns that they possess in their life?
Yes, just like I think in the story of Sati and Daksha, where Daksha had made an offense, and he was forgiven, but he didn't engage in anugraha. In other words, although the one that we may offend, or somebody may offend us, we may forgive them. But if they don't do something for restitution, something for atonement, they still carry some karmic reaction. So it's like that. We should realize that forgiveness is significant. See, that's why Vaishnavas would engage in capital punishment, is that they would arrange for the chastisement, which adjusts for the atonement, and then they forgive after punishment has been given. See, if you just ignore or forgive without rectification and chastisement, then the person still carries the weight. Or you're sending a message to society that such crimes are not so serious. And then it, instead of eradicating or acting as a deterrent for the crimes, it causes people to feel, well, 10 other people did this and they got mercy, and so if I do it, more likely than not, you know, I'll get mercy also. And then it causes more of the deviant activity. But if they see 10 other people did this and this is how they were dealt with, and more likely than not, if I can do this, I'm going to get dealt with the same way, then such person will have that, you know, as a deterrent.
I'm sorry, a follow-up question. How would you explain the behavior of devotees like Jesus?
How would you explain the behavior of great saints like Jesus Christ or Kurvecha, who people abuse them, and even though they abuse them, they were willing to forgive them and even ask God for forgiveness for them without even requesting punishment for them?
Well, with such powerful souls, they are they have purchased, you know, the Lord's full love and attention because they've given their full love and attention. And so in these special cases where a pure agent of the Lord, you know, petitions the Lord, then more than likely, you know, the Supreme Lord will respond to their petition. Just like somebody who makes an offense and they say, oh, please forgive. There's a wonderful story of Mahapurana and Koresh in the story of Ramanujacharya. So Ramanujacharya was very powerful, and his king, you know, wanted to kill him. So he wasn't able to kill Ramanuja. Ramanuja's top servants had some feeling that something wasn't quite right, and they wanted them put on Ramanuja's dress. They went there, and the king, you know, tortured them. Tortured one, Mahapurana, killed him. He died from the torture. And Koresh was blind. So, to make a long story short, Koresh later made an appeal that, you know, that they be forgiven. So even though they tried to kill him and wanted to kill his guru, and they blinded him, he spoke to the deities, and he made an appeal. Instead of asking, Ramanuja sent him particularly to worship a certain deity, knowing that there would be reciprocation. And he had wanted his disciple, Koresh, to ask the deity back for his eyes. But when the deity spoke with him, I mean, he was so devotional and so concerned about the welfare of others, instead of him saying, yes, give me back my eyes, he said, those who've taken my eyes and who tried to kill my guru, you know, please forgive them. And so they weren't asking for forgiveness, but he was doing it. He was intervening in that way. And then when Ramanuja heard this, then he sent him back again and told him, when the deities respond to you next time, you ask them for your eyes. And he did it only because his guru wanted him to be able to see again. So then he asked, oh, my guru Dave has requested that I would petition you to have my eyes back. So in his service, can you please allow me to have my eyes back? So he was able to see. But it shows the power of forgiveness that such great souls have. But it also shows how much the Lord accepts, you know, their prayers and intervenes when they make these petitions. Otherwise, you know, there's heavy consequence. And that's why it's considered, what is it, Bhakya Punja Babika, is when Krishna says, one who worships my devotee, it's greater than worshiping him. Meaning that if my devotee petitions, then I will give extra mercy. My devotee is more merciful than me. Any other questions? And that's why I would say Chaitanya Vaishnava Sevaya Napaja Chakeva, that one must get the dust of the lotus feet of the devotee, which means that in order to really to reach Krishna in a most expedient and profound way, that it comes from healthy sadhu sangha. It comes from association with pure souls who have the power of attorney to represent Krishna. And Krishna will listen even faster when it comes in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Guru Dave, you spoke about death being a great teacher. Could you speak a little bit more about that? And also, is there a correlation between spontaneous astral travel or lucid dreaming or nidra yoga and going through the deaf channel?
Yes, many times, yes and no, but there are many people who have some sense of their impending death, and sometimes it happens through the dream body, through the astral experience. Sometimes it's the Lord in the heart who's allowing them to have some inclination. But a lot of it often happens too, because when the physical body is at rest, the subtle body is more active and it's able to pick up, have all kinds of influences. So one may be more in tune to future than they would in the normal waking state, in the dream state. And then there are times when someone is given some special mercy and they have a near-death experience. It's like a warning that, you know, get your life together because, you know, you're going to go. There are many people who have had near-death experiences and, you know, it's totally changed them because they have an awareness now of how temporary the material body, material life is. And in some cases, they have a transmission with higher beings doing that, those moments. And they come back with tremendous amount of realizations, you know, and knowledge. Some of these people have offered something very special in society after having that kind of experience. And other times, you know, it's very pleasant. Sometimes it's very harsh. They meet the Yamadutas and they realize, oh, I got to stop all these bad habits. They meet, you know, wretched entities who come to greet them and take them away. Other times they meet very pious or very divine beings who let them know it's not your time yet, or you have, you know, this to do or that to do. Or they meet these divine beings and enter into divine states where they are getting an introduction to where they will go and what they will experience. Then when they do die or leave the body, you know, they're not afraid, because they have already kind of got a glimpse of what to expect. Any last question? Yes.
This is a question that people ask all the time, but why does it seem that in our society so many leaders are suffering from very serious health challenges? And even,
well, look at the phenomena of spiritual leadership. Jesus suffered and left at 33 years old. Lord Chaitanya, 43. Sankaracharya, also in his 30s. In other words, there's so many spiritual beings. They come here, they do their work, and they're gone. And they leave, you know, sometimes kind of abruptly, but they leave with big impact, and the mercy is there, and sometimes tremendous suffering comes on them with the people who they're trying to rescue, save. But it's also part of the Leela. What we really, I mean, right now there are what? There are over 2 billion Christians on the planet. Is it 3 billion? Anyways, it's over 2 billion. Then the next is Muslims, and then Hindus, about 1.5 billion. So it must be about 2 billion Muslims, 2.5 or so Christians, 300-something million Buddhists, 14 million Jews. Now, if you look at the 205 billion Christians and others also, one of the main reasons we honor Jesus is because of how he lives, but most important, how he died. The fact that he was so selfless, the fact that he was such a transformer and was so forgiving. If Jesus on the cross would have said, and hey God, you know, damn all of them, kill them all. Show them, they'll never mess with anybody like me again. It would not be the same story. If you look down at everybody, tell them, look, I condemn all of you guys to death for 10 generations. your relatives, 100 generations to the villages that you're in. You're all going to catch hell after this. It would have been a different story. But the fact that how he suffered and how he dealt with his suffering is where we see, you know, the potency and the purity. And that's in any kind of relationship, that you really see the potency of the relationship when there are difficulties. You see the potency of the relationship when things are not always in, you know, the order that we would expect them to be. You got a good team, and when things go haywire and that team just gets in place and do what they have to do, you have a really good team. You got a team and they can only do good when everything is very smooth, and then things get thrown out and everybody just goes crazy and attacks each other and jumps ship, you know, leaves the organization. You realize it wasn't really a good team. Or there's a problem and then people use that to attack other team and players. But when there's an issue and then they somehow they're there and they do their part and they try to compliment and they're taking ownership of what's going on, then you realize you have a good team. So sometimes the Lord shows through these difficulties, he lets us see, you know, the whole experience that, one, this is what we should expect to experience to some degree. We'll never have to suffer the way the high-level souls, agents of the Lord do, or seem to do. But it's a reminder to us, this is part of what goes on in the prison. We read Prabhupada's biography and we see all the things he went through. We look at the life of Buddha, the life of Jesus, the life of Muhammad. We see all the things they went to. It kind of reminds us that being in the mature world means, yeah, opportunity, adventure, and a lot of setbacks and a lot of challenges. But it also means, you know, the God, the Krishna is still there. If, when great souls like Prabhupada come to this planet, and if from day one everything is so smooth for them, we would look at that in awe. We wouldn't be able to identify with it to the same extent. You see? We would say, wow, he was really far out, you know. And we'd worship them almost as God, but we wouldn't feel the same, we wouldn't feel energized, or wouldn't feel that we have to be like them, or that we have to really change ourselves sufficiently. Some people have kind of done that with Jesus by making him God and the only Son. Then they can fall back on, and it's human, it's okay to err. When Jesus' position was to pick up the cross and follow me, his idea was to make people like him, and not just to have people to respect him. So one has to be careful in that way, and that's why you see these great souls undergo different things as really a way to teach and to help. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can we treat the things that happen to us every day? I mean, there's so much in life that comes and goes. Aren't they in some ways preparing us? They're mini deaths in a way, preparing us for death. You know, the relationships that come, the relationships that die, the jobs that come, the jobs that change. You know, all of the back and forth of life seems as though it's very much preparation, mini deaths in a way, preparing us to be equipoised in that flow so that at the moment of death we also understand it's just one bigger step, and there's so many mini steps that have been so much in the same way.
Yeah, I think this is a good question for us to end on. Every trauma is like a death. Every time you change your house, some of you have seen, notice that. You leave one house, go to the next one, it's like a death. Every time you change your car, you know, every time you change your computer, get used to it, you know. Now all of a sudden you got to give it up and accept a new one, even though it's much faster and better. It's like a death to the old one, you know. You get a new piano. This is true. Even when you start gaining weight and you have to give those clothes away that don't fit anymore, it's like a death, you know. Your best dresses, best suits that you really love to wear and you've been keeping in the closet for 2 years thinking you're going to, you know, lose the weight again. Finally you realize that you're just taking up space and you give it away. It's like a death. When you have relationships that sometimes don't, you know, are not substantial, they disappoint you or they change. It's like a death also. So when you realize that life is just full of little death experiences, and then one day you have the Maha death, where it all comes together with all of these experiences, and then it allows you to walk from one space to another space based on all those little tests that you've had. It's like in the university, so you have these little, you know, weekly or monthly tests. Then you have the final exam. And so the final exam usually is to incorporate so many of the other tests and experiences and things that you've read. So if you've done pretty well during the other tests, more than likely you'll do well, you know, on the final exam. But if you haven't done well or processed the other tests properly, then when the final exam comes, you're just totally bewildered, even more bewildered, because this is the one that's going to make you have to stay in the same grade or not allow you, you know, to get the certification. But if you've been prepared, you're nervous, yeah, but you go through it nicely because you've already imbibed and internalized the knowledge that now is fully before you. So death is like that. We're dying daily. This is why I wrote, you know, die before dying, that we are to constantly to be processing these things and looking for Krishna as we go through one change to another change, trying to see what were we to learn, and why did this come to us, why did this relationship, why did this situation come upon us? It didn't have to. For some reason we drew it, for some reason it was part of our growth experience, and now we go through, you know, a maturation as we do through the death experience, and according to how we fared with those relationships and with those situations, now determines, you know, what that future is going to be, which is so-called death. So in one sense, death is really, as we said, and we end with that, it's a victory. It's a graduation ceremony. Because death, for one who has prepared him or herself, means now I can put all the knowledge and understanding that I have, I can allow so much of that to come forth to allow me to get certified, because here's my chance to show what I've been doing. So you've studied medicine, you've studied law all these years, and it wouldn't be right if after all of that, you know, you don't get a license. You would feel horrible. But you do all of that, and then you get your license, and the license proves to some extent, you know, hopefully it's done nicely, to some extent that you're certified and you're bona fide, and people can recognize you as one who's authorized. So you hang out your shingle and you start making money. You start paying back all your debts. You're authorized now to collect to pay back your debts. And then after you pay your debts back and you're a little older, now you can start making some profit. So, but with death, actual death, is that we pay back right away. Is that when the time of death comes, or transition, we can go fully back to the spiritual world. Or we can take it in increments and go to the heavenly kingdoms, or come back with a lot of knowledge, with wealth, and hopefully don't get so entangled this time. This cycle of samsara goes on for some people, hundreds and even millions of lifetimes. And for others, they get it, you know, that life is preparation for death. And that all these experiences are to allow us to embrace life by a healthy consideration of death. Now, before everybody leaves, Maroy, can you distribute everyone a book? Okay. We have the Sri Upanishad, a commentary on the Sri Upanishad. It's one of our biggest books that we've done. It took a long time for it to come out. The devotees in South Africa basically helped to do most of it, and then it came to our Harinam Press here, you know, for the you know, last refinements. And we also have a second edition of Spiritual Warrior 2, Transforming Lust into Love, which is really our most popular book all around the world. You know, we have now 17 books in 13 different languages. We'll be in 13 different languages. And that book has been the most popular. It's been out of print for some time. We printed it in South Africa in English, and we printed it here in America in English. And then it was printed in so many other languages. But our English editions have been out of print for some time. And so we thought we would do a second edition which has a new chapter. The first chapter is new. There's some refinement. As we grow, we also want to express that growth. So we've changed some things. I've changed a few things. My editors have gotten a lot better. They're already good. They've gone from good to great now. So they have made some refinements. And the chapter between a man and a woman, we've extended that. Some people were wondering, with the sannyasi, why am I writing about such? Why should a sannyasi write about such? I thought, okay, I'll write more about it. Because a sannyasi should be a father and should be concerned about the welfare of all. And as sannyasis and gurus, we are, you know, we're having to constantly trying to find husbands for our daughters and wives for our sons. So we are, this is concerned about these things happening right, and we're trying to see how to minimize some of the incoherences and divorces and things. And as a new bookmarker also, with 17, what do we call it? 17 principles of wholeness. You try these 17 principles, we guarantee your marriage will work out nicely. And when it does, you tell them, well, but he did the marriage, told me so. If it doesn't work out, you blame it on the editors. In other countries, blame it on the translators. So, Maroy, before you leave, Maroy will give everybody a copy of the Sri Upanishad. And anybody who wants another copy or would like a copy of the Spiritual Warrior 2, the new edition, then you please get that also. And if you want to give a donation to Maroy for the books, for the press, he'll be more than happy to accept it. And if you don't have a donation, that's also okay. You know, just donate your life. This confounded child of divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srivad Ki. Ai, C.C. Radha Gopinath, Madan Mohan, Jagannath Baladev, Gorni Taiki. Hare Krishna. Nationally perceiving this and that. So we should let them know that wherever they go, there will be problems. But if they're fixing a mission, it's always good, you know, to try to honor that mission, you know. And if they feel the need going back and forth, because sometimes that kind of diversity can be healthy also. But where one may think they put their child in a prep school or send them to this place or to the village, no, there has to be more education and understanding, because wherever anybody's children go now, you know, there's danger. Danger from what they internalize, danger from other people, you know, they're going to have to deal with. And this is one of the downsides of technology, advancement of technology, centralization, commercialization, and globalization. So many good things are also there. I mean, now you can get on. This, for instance, the last class we gave on one of our websites, like 500 people, you know, heard the lecture we gave on Sunday, on Saturday. And then, it's because we're filming for our cable TV, and so thousands of people are just hearing discussion that we're just having now. So now by technology, this is available, that we can do all of this discussion, and, you know, tens of thousands of people on DC cable are hearing, you know, this discussion. At the same time, we're just in the living room, and we're sharing in such a way. So there are many good sides and, you know, downsides also. But if they think about that a little closer, they realize the important thing is wherever they are to create more, you know, of a secure circle of associates, and for them to align themselves more, you know, with a spiritual mission. And then hopefully their children will take up the same kind of spirit. So I think we'll stop now and let you have peace while you're eating. And I'll be back either tomorrow or maybe tonight. Maybe it's too much endeavor to go up and come. I'll be back tonight. I'll be back tomorrow. And I'll be here until the 23rd. And then 23rd afternoon or 24th morning, I'll go to Gidanagri for some time. But I'll be back and forth because most of my treatments or visitations to the clinics and hospitals, you know, are here. Okay. So, you know, just keep in mind, each of us can make a difference, and we all have so much more impact on others than we ever realize. Those of you who are parents or will be parents, that you are, you know, establishing what the future will be. And it happens even before, of course, the child comes out, because while the child is in the womb, so much of the integration of consciousness is already taking place. It happens even before procreation, because the consciousness, when you enter into procreation, is going to draw a certain type of soul. So this wonderful little girl and some of the other small children that are coming into the community, Prabhupada had mentioned how we'll see some very special qualities. The children of our children, our first generation, and then the second, then the children, and so Gauravani's daughter is in that generation, that we'll see very empowered entities. And how wonderful it will be when they have the environment that allows them to be able to, you know, to access and to use what they have. And a tremendous embarrassment or will be unfortunate for our activities in trying to raise consciousness. We have such beings who then get shut down because of our lack of ability to encourage them. When you have someone who's very powerful and they're being stagnated, what happens? They become powerfully destructive to themselves and to others. And so there's this, you know, there's this big risk. When you are quite devotional and you have a very devotional husband and devotional wife, and you're also procreating based on powerful rituals, you're going to bring in very strong, empowered entities. And if you don't give them the proper guidance, then with that power, they're going to give you hell. Because that energy will be then projected first on those who are closest to them, and the, you know, and then on the environment, you know, if it's not used and channeled in the proper way. Think about the difference between the asuras and the asuras. The difference between, say, the devas, the angelic or the demigods, and those empowered for destruction, like the demonic class, is that in each case they have power. They have paranormal powers. In one case there's piety, in the other case there's impiety. So where we have these very powerful beings coming forth, if we are not able to allow them the proper protection, especially, they'll become like impious with all the power that they have. When they take the sense gratification, they will be big sense gratifiers. When they come to manipulation, they'll be big, big manipulators, because they'll have that shakti. ISKCON found the child that Siddha Prabhupada ki. Shri Sri Vara Gopinath ki. Vara Madan Mohan ki. Hare Krishna.